Lecture 2, The Homeric Question.
Hello, and welcome back to Lecture 2. In our previous lecture, we discussed the structure of the Odyssey and looked especially at the way the opening scenes in Ithaca stress the need for Odysseus's return. In this lecture, we're going to continue our examination of the first four books of the Odyssey and give special attention to how these books set up and define a key theme of the Odyssey, the concept of xenia. Now, xenia is one of the most important themes in the Odyssey, and it's yet another Greek term that lacks an adequate English definition. It is often translated, the term xenia is often translated as the guest-host relationship, and that rather cumbersome, rather awkward formulation tells you right away that we have neither exactly an equivalent word nor exactly an equivalent concept in English for the Greek concept of xenia. Hospitality is also sometimes used as a translation, but that's much too weak a word because it does not include with it the sense of divine sanction, of absolute responsibility, of hospitality as a duty, not as something that one chooses to do or not to do. Xenia is a reciprocal relationship in the Odyssey and in the Iliad as well, for that matter. Xenia is a reciprocal relationship between two xenoi. That's the plural. The singular is xenos. We can get a little bit closer to understanding what xenia is, perhaps, by looking at what the word xenos means. Xenos can be translated, depending on context, as guest, host, stranger, foreigner, and friend. Now, if I can get you to understand how one word can mean five things that in our way of thinking seem so very different, guest, host, stranger, foreigner, and friend, then I can bring you to an understanding of what xenia, the abstract relationship between one xenos and another, actually is. Xenos means these five different things because it is a word that refers to a particular kind of friendship, not affection or fondness, but the relationship that two people enter into once they have been in the guest-host relationship with one another. Let's look at it from the guest's point of view, first off. Let's imagine that in the Odyssey, or in any other epic from this time frame, someone is traveling away from his own community. At nightfall, what does he do? And I say he here because, with the exception of disguised goddesses such as Athena, it always is a he who partakes in xenia. When night falls, what does the traveler do? What does this person do? He can't go to a hotel. There is no such thing. He needs somewhere to stay. He needs shelter. He needs a meal. He needs a bath, a change of clothing, all of those things. What can he do? What he does is he presents himself at the door of a house that looks as though it's about his same social status. If he's a very poor man, a beggar, he would go to the hut of another poor man. If he's a king's son, he would go to the palace in the town that he's come to. Once he gets there, he knocks on the door and basically says, "Here I am, put me up for the night." So he is a xenos in the sense of being a guest, because the person on whose house to whose house he has come will take him in and put him up for the night. But he's also clearly a xenos in the sense of being foreigner. Foreigner here is defined very, very narrowly. Basically, someone who's from another town counts as a foreigner. And of course, by the way, it's that sense of xenos that gives us our word xenophobia, fear of foreigners. So this person who appears and knocks on the door, as soon as he crosses the threshold, he will be a guest. He's also a foreigner. He's also a stranger. The householder has never seen him before. Once he has been taken in, given a meal, allowed to sleep overnight, and so forth, he becomes a friend, but again, only in this stylized sense of friend. This has nothing to do, again, with fondness or affection, but simply with the recognition that a bond has been established between these two people that remains and carries on hereditarily, by the way. Their children, if they ever meet, will have obligations to one another. The householder, obviously, is a xenos in the sense of host in this setup. And so the word xenos means all of these things: guest, host, stranger, foreigner, friend. And the relationship between one xenos and another is the concept that we describe by the term xenia. Now, obviously, such concept, such a situation can only work if both participants in it are very strongly motivated not to abuse the relationship of Xenia. The guest must not rob, murder, or otherwise mistreat his host. Similarly, the host must not in any way mistreat the guest. I always say to my students when I'm teaching the Odyssey in a college, not to try this at home. Do not, when you're traveling in a strange city, go and knock on someone's door and say, hello, I need somewhere to stay for the night, and by the way, I'd like a really good meal while you're at it. It's not going to work. For it to work in any society, obviously, there has to be a very strong sense of obligation and a sense of sanctions against you if you violate Xenia. And this is where, as so often in the Iliad and the Odyssey both, the gods come into play. Xenia is validated by, is protected by, is overseen by no less a god than Zeus himself. One of Zeus's titles is Zeus Xenios, Zeus the god of Xenia. So a guest who mistreats his host, a host who mistreats or turns away a guest, has directly offended the god Zeus and will undoubtedly suffer for it. And now you're in a position to think back on the episode or the cause of the Trojan War when Paris abducted Helen. Along with everything else he was violating by doing that, he was violating Xenia. Paris had gone to stay with Helen and Menelaus. He was Menelaus's Xenos, and he ran away with Menelaus's wife. That is about as bad a violation of Xenia as one can well imagine. That is something a guest is absolutely not supposed to do. You're not supposed to run away with your host's wife. So the Trojan War, among all its other aspects, is fought over a violation of Xenia. So this is an extremely important concept, particularly for the Odyssey, but also for the Iliad as well. Throughout the Odyssey, Odysseus's homecoming and regaining of his family and kingdom are either helped or hindered by the kind of Xenia he meets on his journeys. Since he is away from home and traveling, obviously he's dependent on this guest-host relationship to help him on his way or to hinder him. And so Xenia becomes one of the central themes of the Odyssey purely because Odysseus has to depend on it so much. Its primary importance as a conceptual framework almost for the Odyssey is set up throughout the first four books of the Odyssey, which I now want to turn back to. In the first four books of the Odyssey, we see Telemachus experiencing Xenia from just about every possible angle. Along with everything else that these books are doing thematically, they are setting up, describing, painting a picture of Xenia and how it ought to work and how it ought not to work. Telemachus is without question the most important character in the first four books of the Odyssey. In fact, the first four books are often called the Telemachy. If the Odyssey is a book about Odysseus, the Telemachy is a book about Telemachus, and the first four books of the Odyssey are conventionally referred to as the Telemachy, simply to stress how crucially important Telemachus is in these books. And Xenia is one very important element in the bard's characterization of Telemachus. In books one and two, we see Telemachus dealing with Xenia from the host's perspective while he is at home on Ithaca. In books three and four, we see him traveling to visit his father's old comrades in arms, Nestor and Menelaus. There he experiences Xenia from the guest's point of view when Nestor and Menelaus both take him into their houses and treat him as hosts should treat a guest. Xenia is also crucial for our understanding of the suitors, those suitors who are trying to marry Penelope and take over Telemachus's household. Interestingly enough, their wrongdoing is couched almost entirely in terms of a violation of Xenia. Telemachus himself stresses this in book two of the Odyssey, when he calls an assembly of the men of Ithaca and talks publicly about what the suitors have done wrong. The terms in which he puts it are terms that make sense in Xenia. He says that the suitors have done wrong not just by courting Penelope when she doesn't want them to court her, but by hanging out in Telemachus's house, sacrificing and eating his flocks of animals, drinking his wine. He actually says that they're wasting away his substance. They're destroying his possessions. And one crucial aspect of Xenia that I haven't yet mentioned is that it is supposed to be an absolutely reciprocal relationship. If a guest can, he's supposed to give a gift to his host. If he can't give a gift to his host, he's at least supposed to leave before he's worn out his welcome. He's not supposed to hang out for years eating his host's food, wearing his host's clothes, and so forth. The reciprocity of Xenia normally plays itself out not between two individual guests and hosts, but rather in the broader idea that if I am a guest this year, next year I'll be a host, perhaps not to the same man who hosted me this year, but to someone, so that it balances out in the long run. And a host is supposed to feel a sense of obligation because of the times in the past when he had been a guest, and vice versa. The suitors are ignoring the essentially reciprocal nature of Xenia by giving nothing in return to Telemachus. And this is how Telemachus states what they've done wrong in the assembly in Book 2 of the Odyssey. He says that they give nothing in return. They eat his animals, they drink his wine, they give nothing in return. So Xenia helps us understand Telemachus. It also is very important in characterizing the suitors. When we first see Telemachus in Ithaca, we also see the concept of Xenia used to highlight the conflict between Telemachus and the suitors. Our very first view of Telemachus shows him receiving a Xenos, a guest. This guest happens to be Athena in disguise. She's disguised as a human man, which always gives me a little bit of a problem at this point in discussing the Odyssey. I don't know whether to refer to Athena as her or as him at this point. Telemachus sees a man come to the door. We know it's Athena. The bard tends to use her, so I guess I'll stick with the female pronouns here. But remember that Telemachus thinks he is hosting a human man. He doesn't know he's hosting the disguised goddess Athena. When Athena comes to the door of the palace, and this is the very first time we actually see Telemachus, the first thing we see Telemachus do is greet his guest in the first of many of the Odyssey's host greeting guest scenes. Telemachus goes to the door, greets Athena, takes her by the hand, says, "Welcome, Xenos," to her. And that is another challenging translation problem for anyone dealing with this scene in the Odyssey. Telemachus says, "Welcome, Xenos." How do you translate Xenos there? Welcome, friend? Welcome, guest? Welcome, stranger? Welcome, foreigner? In English, you pretty much have to pick one. The word Telemachus says means all of them. He takes her hand, bids her welcome, takes her spear away from her. Now, that's an interesting little point. Obviously, from the guest's point of view, the host is supposed to take any burdens you're carrying, you know, take whatever luggage you have, anything you're carrying with you. From the host's point of view, though, it makes very good sense to disarm your guest. If the guest happens to be carrying a spear or any other weapon, you very politely take that and set it aside just until you're sure that this guest does recognize the protocols of Xenia and will abide by them. Telemachus then takes his guest into the palace, offers her food, a bath, and a bed for the night. And here comes an absolutely crucial element of Xenia. It is only after the guest's immediate physical needs have been met. Usually that's for the most immediate need is usually for a meal. It's only after the immediate physical needs have been attended to that the host may ask the guest, "Who are you?" Telemachus waits until after Athena has eaten before he asks her who she is. Now, I think the point of that little detail, the reason that it's seen as a violation of Xenia to ask your guest, "Who are you?" the instant you go to the door and meet the guest, is because the relationship of Xenia, the practice of Xenia, is not supposed to depend on whether the host likes the guest or doesn't, knows the guest or doesn't, in any way has any feelings about the guest or not. It's supposed to be purely a matter of this person is here and needs help and the host must help him. If the host begins by saying, "Who are you?" there is implicit in that the idea that if the host doesn't like the answer, you know, if it turns out that this person is the grandson of your old arch enemy or some such, that the host could say, "Go away, I'm not going to help you." So one of the protocols of Xenia, I try to avoid the word rules because there wasn't a rule book. This wasn't ever set out anywhere formally, but one of the protocols of Xenia was that the host may only ask the guest, who are you, after the guest's most immediate needs have been attended to. So when we first meet Telemachus, so to speak, in the Odyssey, we see that he knows how to act as a proper host in his greeting of his guest, Athena. And while they're eating, and after their meal, they have a conversation in which Telemachus's two main concerns, the two things that are troubling him, are brought out. He unburdens himself, he opens his heart to Athena, tells her his troubles. And his troubles are twofold: his grief over his absent father and his anger at the suitor's behavior. Now, Athena, of course, is here specifically to advise Telemachus and to help Telemachus. We, as the audience, know that. Athena said to Zeus at the beginning of Book One that while Zeus was sending Hermes off to tell Calypso to let Odysseus go, she, Athena, would go down to Ithaca and see Telemachus. She said specifically to put some heart into him, to stir him up a little bit, to give him that last little push to launch him into maturity. Up to this point, Telemachus has not asserted himself. He strikes many readers as rather surprisingly immature for a young man who must, after all, be about 20 years old by this time. He acts much younger than that in many ways. Athena's motivation in going to Ithaca to see him is not just to allow him to find out that his father is still alive. He will find that out from Menelaus. But more than that, to encourage him to assert himself as an adult, to take action. And Athena encourages Telemachus to do this in two ways. She tells him to call a council of all the men of Ithaca in Book Two. He does this. And to openly and publicly denounce the suitors for how they are acting, how they're destroying his substance, for their violations of Xenia. She also tells him to travel and visit Nestor and Menelaus and see if he can get any news of his father. Now, Athena, of course, knows that Odysseus will be home any day now. She's just told Zeus to send Hermes to tell Calypso to let Odysseus go. She could just tell Telemachus, I'm Athena, Odysseus will be home any day now. But she doesn't do that because, again, she wants Telemachus to assert himself, to go off on his own, to have a chance to act as an adult in his own right before his father does, in fact, return home. So Telemachus takes the advice of this guest, whom, of course, he does not know as Athena, and in the council that he calls in Book Two of the Odyssey, he directly accuses the suitors of violating Xenia. Now, neither he nor Athena ever used the term violating Xenia, but that is clearly what they're talking about in effect, though they don't put it in exactly that terminology. Telemachus, as I already mentioned, denounces the suitors for destroying his goods without ever giving anything in return. And he's backed up in this denunciation of the suitors by a prophet, an old man, a seer, a reader of omens, Halitherses, who predicts misfortune for the suitors if they do not mend their ways. Halitherses sees an omen, a flight of birds in the sky, and as very frequently in the Iliad and the Odyssey both, birds flying by are omens that specially trained or specially gifted seers and prophets can interpret. In this omen, Halitherses sees two eagles fly by that Zeus sends. They fly by and overhead and tear one another with their talons. Halitherses interprets this omen to mean that Odysseus is going to return home soon and that there will be terrible repercussions for the suitors if they do not change their behavior before Odysseus comes home. Now, the response of the suitors to Halitherses' prophecy is, I think, absolutely essential for our understanding both of the suitors' character and of how we're supposed to view these suitors in the Odyssey. One of the suitors, their spokesman, Eurymachus, responds to Halitherses after Halitherses has said that Odysseus is about to come home and the suitors must change their ways or suffer the consequences. Eurymachus, answering Halitherses, says, "Old man, better go home and prophesy to your children for fear they may suffer some evil to come. In these things I can give a much better interpretation than you can. Many are the birds who wander under the sun's rays. Not all of them mean anything. Odysseus is dead far away, and how I wish that you had died with him also. Then you would not be announcing all these predictions, nor would you so stir up Telemachus, who is now angry." And Eurymachus continues his speech. It's a fairly long speech by saying, if you keep doing this, Halitherses, if you keep stirring up Telemachus, we'll lay a penalty on you that will make you very sorry, and that Telemachus must tell Penelope, choose a husband and marry now. We're not going to go away until she does, because, he concludes, in any case, we fear no one, and surely not Telemachus, for all he is so eloquent. Nor do we care for any prophecy which you, old sir, may tell us, which will not happen, and will make you even more hated. And his, that is Telemachus's, possessions will wretchedly be eaten away. There will not be compensation ever while she, Penelope, makes the Achaeans put off marriage with her. Now, what Eurymachus has done in this speech is really rather stunning. In one fell swoop, he has shown disrespect for, disregard for, contempt for just about every important element of the mores of his society. He's shown disrespect to an old man to begin with, and this is a society in which the old are definitely respected. He has shown disrespect to a prophet, which by implication means disrespecting the god whom that prophet serves, in this case, Zeus. He has said Odysseus is dead and made it quite clear that he's glad Odysseus is dead. This is showing disrespect to his rightful king. And if Odysseus is dead, in that case, who is Eurymachus's rightful king? Well, Telemachus. And what does Eurymachus say about Telemachus? Nothing good, I'm afraid. He goes on to say, we don't care about prophecies, which in effect means we don't care about the gods. We're going to force Penelope to marry, whether she likes it or not. Everything that ought to be respected in this society, the old, prophecy, the gods, the king, the rights of the king, the rights of the king's son, all of those in one speech, Eurymachus simply spits on. And I think this is very important, as I said, for understanding not just Eurymachus's character, but the character of all the suitors. Odysseus, before the end of the Odyssey, is going to kill all of these suitors. There are 108 of them, by the way. He's going to kill all of them. And it seems to me, although not all scholars would agree with this, it seems to me that we are supposed to approve of that, that we're supposed to see the suitors as so beyond the pale of decent society, as having so set themselves outside the mores of their society that they have to be dealt with harshly. There's nothing else to be done with them. The contrast between Telemachus and the suitors is enhanced by the fact and underlined by the fact that most of these suitors, like Telemachus, are sons of absent fathers. When Odysseus went off to war, he didn't go alone. He took all the men of Ithaca who were of fighting age with him. Now, some of the suitors have fathers still present on Ithaca. Some of them have fathers who were too old to go to war 20 years previously and now are very old indeed. But most of their fathers are gone with Odysseus. And so the disorder in Ithacan society can be seen as, in one way, reflecting what happens to a society when all the fathers are gone. And I think in that regard, the character of Telemachus on the one hand, the character of the suitors on the other hand, are an almost frighteningly realistic portrait of what can happen to young men who grow up with no fathers. Telemachus is immature, unable to assert himself until Athena encourages him, but up till this point has been unable to assert himself, has been, to use a term I normally don't much like, a mama's boy. The suitors, on the other hand, are completely out of control, completely disregarding all the mores of their society, completely reckless. Those seem to me to be really the two extremes of what does happen, what would happen in a society where all the fathers were missing and the sons grew up without any fathers to guide them and to teach them how to behave. So the disorder in Ithacan society runs much deeper than a disorder in Xenia, but it is represented by, indicated by, this disorder in Xenia that plays itself out in Telemachus's or Odysseus's household. Moving on to books 3 and 4. In these books, we see a view of Xenia working properly with Telemachus this time as guest rather than as host. In book 3, Telemachus visits Nestor, the oldest and wisest of the Greeks, at Pylos. He's guided there by Athena, disguised this time as a human being named Mentor, an old friend of Odysseus. And this is, of course, where we get the term mentor for an older person who guides a younger person. Mentor, aka Athena, guides Telemachus to Pylos, where Telemachus meets and interacts with Nestor. Nestor receives Telemachus absolutely properly, as a good host should. He gives him a meal, he provides a bed, he provides a bath the next morning. He doesn't ask Telemachus who he is until after Telemachus is eaten. All the elements of proper Xenia are there. Nestor also suggests that Telemachus should visit Menelaus in Sparta because Menelaus has just recently returned home from his own wanderings. And he provides Telemachus with horses and a chariot so that Telemachus can make the journey in the hope that Menelaus, recently returned home as he is, may have heard something about Odysseus. Nestor also gives his son Pisistratus to Telemachus as a traveling companion on his journey to Sparta. And in Book 4, Telemachus and Pisistratus visit Menelaus and Helen at Sparta. Once again, they're greeted and entertained properly and feasted, given beds, given baths, so forth. And one other element of Xenia that I haven't mentioned yet, they are given guest gifts. They're given guest gifts when they leave, gifts that are provided for guests. Now, we don't actually see Telemachus leave Sparta in Book 4. In fact, Telemachus doesn't actually leave Sparta until Book 15. But Menelaus talks about the wonderful gifts that he'll give Telemachus when Telemachus actually leaves. Book 3 and 4, along with stressing Xenia, also provide some crucial background narrative material, crucial both for Telemachus and for us. At Telemachus's request, Nestor recounts events that took place after the fall of Troy. He talks about the homecomings of several Greeks, although he doesn't know what's happened to Odysseus. But also, more importantly, Nestor tells Telemachus the story of how Agamemnon was murdered by his wife Clytemnestra and her lover Aegisthus when Agamemnon returned home from Troy. Now, this story, Agamemnon's homecoming to be murdered by a treacherous wife and her new lover, her new man. This is repeated over and over again throughout the Odyssey as a kind of alternative version of what could happen to Odysseus if Penelope were not faithful. Agamemnon and Clytemnestra keep coming up in the Odyssey. People keep talking about them. We'll even see the ghost of Agamemnon himself in Book 11 of the Odyssey. Nestor stresses the aspect of the story in which Agamemnon's son Orestes avenged his father's murder. And Nestor seems to be saying pretty clearly to Telemachus, go thou and do likewise, go and get rid of the suitors. Defend your father's honor. It's a little bit rough on Telemachus. There are 108 suitors, after all, a little bit much to expect him to get rid of all of them by himself. But Nestor is pretty clearly citing this story as a paradigm for Telemachus to try to follow. In Telemachus's visit to Menelaus and Helen in Sparta, the conversation turns to Troy, and Telemachus weeps when Menelaus mentions Odysseus. This is a very interesting little episode, this visit to Menelaus and Helen. Helen recognizes Telemachus. She says he looks so much like Odysseus that he must be Odysseus' son. And when Telemachus is weeping over his lost father, and Menelaus is weeping over all the men who were lost at the war, and Pisistratus, Nestor's son, is weeping over his elder brother who died at the war, Helen drugs the three men. She gives them an Egyptian drug called nepenthe, which means no pain or no grief, so that they will stop grieving. And while they're under the influence of nepenthe, which we're told is so powerful that someone who had drunk it could feel no grief at all, even if his family was slaughtered before his face that very day, he could feel no grief. While the men are under the influence of this drug, Helen tells a story, supposedly to show how clever Odysseus was, about how Odysseus once came into Troy in disguise and she recognized him and helped him. Menelaus counters with the story about how when the Greeks were hiding in the Trojan horse, Helen walked around mimicking their wives' voices, trying to lure them out, and Odysseus was the only one who recognized what was going on and kept the others from crying out. So Menelaus, in effect, says, yes, Helen, you're right. Odysseus was indeed a very clever man. Why, I remember that time when you tried to murder all of us, and he was the one who kept you from doing it. This episode between Helen and Menelaus, as I said, is an extremely problematic one. There's a lot of scholarship that's been written on this episode. One thing it does, at least, is to show us Helen is still being ambiguous, just as she was in the Iliad, even here in the Odyssey. She's still ambiguous. Did she want to be at Troy? Did she not want to be at Troy? She seems to imply no. Menelaus seems to imply yes. Most importantly for Telemachus, Menelaus recounts his conversation that he had while in Egypt with a minor sea god named Proteus, who told Menelaus about Agamemnon's death, about the death of Ios the Lesser at sea in recompense for raping Cassandra. And, this is the crucial point, Proteus told Menelaus that Odysseus was being kept captive by the nymph Calypso. Now, this means that Telemachus knows his father was still alive as recently as a couple of years ago when Menelaus spoke to Proteus. It's not entirely good news. Odysseus is a prisoner of a goddess, but it gives Telemachus reason to hope that Odysseus will in fact return. And Telemachus, as we've seen, has also had the chance to assert himself as an adult in his own right before his father's return. The Telemachy ends, Book 4 of the Odyssey ends, with a brief look back at Ithaca. We see the suitors plotting to murder Telemachus when he returns. Now that he's acting like an adult, now that he's asserted himself and taken some authority, they decide the only way to deal with him is to kill him, and they plot to murder him when he returns. We see Penelope weeping for Odysseus one more time before Book 4 of the Odyssey ends. And so the situation on Ithaca is now set firmly enough in our minds that the bard can put it on hold for the next several books of the Odyssey. We won't see Telemachus again until Book 15. We won't see Penelope until Book 16. The bard has established how desperately Odysseus is needed. He's set the scene on Ithaca. The suitors are waiting in ambush to kill Telemachus. Now the bard can turn to Odysseus himself, as we will do in the next lecture.